Good evening, folks. This is Scotty Roberts with Intrepid Radio, and I'm sitting here with my cohort,
Dr. John Ward.
And we are, of course, doing these daily segments for the Exodus Reality Adventure. And so here we are. We are sat aboard the deck, the upper deck of our Dahabeah. Now, John, why don't you tell everybody again, remind them what a Dahabeah is.
Well, a Dahabeah is the vintage, I suppose is the best word to use, the vintage way of traveling up the Nile, or down the Nile, depending on which direction you're going.
No, before you go further, let me just correct everybody, or not correct, let me put a note in here. If you're hearing car horns, we are on a boat, yes, but we are moored right now at the moment. We cast off in the morning. And John will tell you a little bit. Or do we cast off tonight?
No, we cast off in the morning.
In the morning. So we're sleeping aboard the boat tonight, and we are moored up to the main town in the village of Esna right now. And so, John, go ahead and tell them more about of boat that we're on. I just thought I'd alleviate the confusion.
I didn't think there was any confusion, but there you go.
Well, if we say we're on board a boat and you hear all kinds of traffic, cars and trucks and honking going by,
true.
What do you...
Okay, I'll give you that.
You say they're not on a boat.
True. Anyway, so the Dahabeah is a beautiful sailing boat. I'm not actually too sure about the age of this one. I think it is actually in excess of 100 years. We've got two masts, one at the bow and one at the stern. Nowadays, of course, we have the modern tugboat that will maneuver us up and down the Nile when there's lack of wind. But when the wind is up, the tugboat departs the Dahabeah and she goes under her own steam, so to speak. And it's a beautiful sight to see. The boat itself, I'm not too sure about the length of this one. Do we know?
Do you know what the length of this boat is?
What's the length of this boat, this particular boat? Can you remember?
The length.
This is going to be a guess, isn't it? This is going to be a guess. 14 meters in length.
Yeah. A meter is roughly what? 30 inches. So.
30. I hope it's a bit bigger than 30 inches.
I don't even know what a meter is.
Meter.
But anyway,
it's about 10 miles.
The boat itself is going to be our home now for the next 4 to 5 days. As we travel down the Nile, we'll be stopping off at the temple sites, as we've discussed previously before, the Temple of Edfu. We'll be viewing and visiting the Temple of Esna tomorrow morning. And then after Edfu, we'll be going on to the great Gibel El Sisila and spending the night there. Then onwards towards Komombo, and then down further towards Aswan, where we'll be visiting the sites of Aswan itself. Scott.
Yes, well, today, let's just give you a little report of what's been going on so far. Our last report, well, you heard when we were at the Giza Plateau, you heard about Serbet El Khedim, where we were we left there actually.
When did we leave there? I've lost
yesterday.
Count.
Yesterday. I think it was yesterday. Yes, and we were back in Cairo last night, and we visited today a magnificent site, Saqqara, and this is with the stepped pyramid of Djoser, and the enclosure that's about it, and the temple is there, the compound that is there. And we had a magnificent visit there. We also went down to the Serapeum, which is at the same site, which is the underground burial chambers for the Apis bull. And John, talk about the Apis bull. What is the significance of the Apis bull, and why did they have these vast underground chambers? It's like walking through catacombs with, 27 different...
Yeah. I mean, they are actually catacombs. They're classed as such. Now, one of the guys on one of our guests was mentioning why was the sarcophagi so huge? Why were they so big? Well, basically, they had to actually take the entire mummified corpse of the Apis bull itself.
What were the lids on those sarcophagi? They're like 2 tons themselves.
Well, actually, I'm not too sure of the entire weight, but they've got to be coming up to about 10.
Length of the sarcophagus?
Yes.
60 tons.
Guys, granite. just to introduce you here, we've got Sat Bias murmuring away to himself and trying to rectify my tiredness, I must admit. Our good friend and chief inspector of Komombo, and Gebel El Sisila, my boss, by the way, and that is Mr. Ahmed Said. So, Mr. Ahmed Said, say hello to the folks around the world.
Hello, my friends.
Yeah. So,
how is that in there in USA nowadays? It's cold or it's hot or what is it now?
I like it.
Well, yeah. Right now it's kind of cool. We're sitting out on the deck of the boat.
Looks like just, yeah.
It's cold.
It's cold.
Oh, what it is?
It's not cold here. You mean that?
In the United States, it's very cold. Right
very
now.
Cold. But here it's just cold. You know,
it's just cool tonight. Yeah, it's a bit warm during the day.
Yeah, on the day, yeah, you know that we have just two seasons here in Egypt. You know,
yes.
hot and hotter. That's what we have. Yeah. But there, I think. Yeah.
So what did you say was the weight of the sarcophagi?
It's about 60 tons.
60
made
tons.
Of granite came yes. from. Aswan, you know.
Well, we were discussing this today, actually, in the Serapeum itself. We were looking at them, and I was trying to convey to the guests that the sarcophagus themselves was made from the red granite of Aswan. Yeah. And I tried to convey to them that the sarcophagus was quarried as one lump,
yeah.
then dressed, carved. Now, this is a question for you, Ahmed.
Yes.
Do you think it was carved and dressed in situ in Aswan? Or do you think it was transported as one quarried block all the way to Cairo, to the Serapeum, and then dressed in situ there? What do you think that was? Do you think it was dressed here in Aswan?
Is it in the quarry?
Yes.
Original quarry.
Yeah, dressed, it was cut and, from there, but
yeah,
was it dressed?
Yeah, already to move from here one by one by the River Nile.
But was it dressed and finished?
Yeah, and finished everything here.
So it was all cut, done, dressed.
So it was delivered.
It looks like the obelisk, you know?
Yes.
It is seen,
so yeah. It was delivered down the Nile and all the way up to Cairo, near Cairo, what is today Cairo,
yeah.
to Saqqara, fully inscribed, ready to go.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
And out of interest, and this is just for the folks back home.
Yeah.
What transported, because, I mean, most people who listen to our show, they have... We talk about the various different techniques and so forth associated with quarrying, especially Gebel El Sisila, which they all know about. But for the folks back home, how would they have transported such a huge megalithic block of
60
stone?
Tons.
60 tons.
60 tons.
How would they have actually transported that?
We think that they're using the same things which in the quarry of Gebel El Sisila, mm-hmm. that they're using the sloping ways from the quarry to the River Nile,
yeah.
using the wood under the.
So you're saying they use the roller system?
Your rolling system, yeah.
A rolling system on 60 tons.
Exactly. They're using also a lot of people there, using for. I mean, because of they was working for one by one. Not imagine that about hundreds of people, workers. They're working for just one sarcophagus.
Yes.
Yeah, that's why. It's not too much. Looks like the quarry of Gebel El Sisila or
no.
something. Just imagine that's hundreds of people they're working for just one.
Just one.
For just one.
I mean, I was amazed. I mean, as you know, I mean, we both of us have seen up close the various techniques used and employed at Gebel El Sisila. I was with one of our guests today, Gail, and we climbed up a little bit and we were able to run our finger just along the edge of the sarcophagus, and I mean, it's perfectly sharp. It's perfect.
It's smooth.
It's so perfect. It's unbelievable. Yeah. And Gail asked me the question: well, how did they manage to get such a clean edge? What do you think? How did they do that? I know the answer.
I know the answer.
I'm just putting you on the spot.
I'm guessing that after they finish, the four sides,
yeah.
you know, they give it on one of the sides, and then they start to work before they move it.
And for the folks back home, you're making that movement there with your hand, but they can't see you because this is radio.
Yeah.
So what were they using in their hand? Was that a stone, a rubbing stone?
You know, your diorite.
A diorite. Diorite stone.
You know, diorite stones, because it's stronger than the... It's the same which used in the obelisk. If you... When you go to the obelisks in Aswan...
Which we will be there.
We'll be there, yeah? And we're going to see a thousand and thousand of those small stones which use at the hands to polish, to cut, to use as a hammer as well,
yeah.
of Durait.
Now, guys, unfortunately, this is Ahmed's first time on radio, so he's not got the hang of this yet. So I'm going to try and explain to you what he was trying to do with his hands and motion there.
I'm sorry. What I'm not on the TV. I used to
be
on the TV.
He's a TV man, guys, not a radio guy.
He's a gesticulator.
Yeah. So what Ahmed was showing or gesticulating towards us there was holding, and we'll see these actually, and we'll take some photographs and images and we'll post them up for you so you can all see these. But they're small handheld roundish rocks, for a better word, made of diorite. Now, the diorite, when it comes into application with the granite itself, it acts as an abrasive, like sandpaper. Now, Ahmed, do they add anything between the diorite? So if I've got a clear side of granite in front of me, and I've got my diorite ball in one hand, do I put anything between the diorite ball and the granite? Do they use sand or water?
Water.
They added water for the friction.
Water.
So the water added as friction between
especially
the two surfaces.
Especially for the strong stones.
Yeah.
Just getting, you know, if you use those two kinds of stones, very strong, it's getting too hard.
Okay.
I mean, it's difficult also to use it without
water. Now, here's the big question. How did they separate the lid from the block?
You mean the main block?
Yes. How did they? Because when you're in the Serapeum and you're looking at it, it's two parts. You've got the main sarcophagus, then you've got the lid.
Using wood.
So how did they separate the lid?
Know, how did they cut?
Using the wood, the wood. They put wood between them after they make small holes.
Yeah.
And then using water. You know, to make it.
So you're saying one of the old theories where they would take a wooden wedge.
Yes.
They would make a hole along the horizontal of the granite
and
block.
And then wood.
And then they put a wooden wedge in.
Yeah.
And then add water where the wooden wedge would then soak the water.
Yeah.
Expand. And when
then
it expands,
after
it would expand, split.
Cleaned.
It would split. Yeah. Split the block.
Thus, you'd
be able to then clean and dress the lid. And clean and dress the underside of the astral sarcophagus where the lid would fall.
This is very well idea for the granites, for diorite, for the strong things.
But how would they lift it? How do they keep that suspended? How would they lift that? Once they've cut it, once they've separated the lid from the sarcophagus, how do they then lift it? What mechanism, what machinery did they use to lift the lid?
Using, you know, they depend on the numbers of the human. They're working with them.
How many workers?
The animals as well. Using some of animals with them. They're using all of the kinds, looks like, you know, the ropes and...
using ropes and pulley
especially
systems.
Yeah.
So it's a pulley system, same as what we have
pulley
in Sicilia.
System, exactly. It's the same.
Yeah.
Now, do we have any evidence of any trial and error in this? If they cut that lid off incorrectly, could they fix that by the way they would sand it and finish the stone, or would they ever have to, in a sense, start all over again?
You know, we think if you, for example, if you go to some quarries, looks like that which in Shalal in Aswan, the quarry of diorite of Kefrin.
Yeah, the Kefrin
in the south of Aswan.
Yeah,
you're gonna see something is not completed. You know, in Jabal Sisil as well.
Yeah.
Something is not completed. That's me. We don't know it's not completed or there is some problem or they have we don't know. I mean, maybe because of the core of the stone itself or the kind of the stone itself was not good. So they lift it.
Why have we got you here, Ahmed? There's a question that's burning in my head. And as an Egyptian, I want to ask you this. Why on earth do they honk their horns continuously?
All
do they long. Do they have a problem with their finger that they have to...
It's not... We are not sitting, folks, in a busy city.
Yeah.
We're sitting in a small riverside town. And I don't know what the population is here exactly, but you've got one strip of shops.
This is supposed to be a very, very quiet, incessantly. Very quiet city. You know,
it's not that quiet at the moment.
And also today is what? Today is Sunday.
Yes.
That means, you know, we have two sacred days. The Monday night on Friday night. If you look here, I mean, or not look, because I'm just looking. I'm talking just.
Yeah.
For you, please.
In your mind's eye.
Yeah. In your mind's eye.
We have some of weddings today. This is the night of weddings, so you're gonna see a lot of klaxons, a lot of voice, and because we have mini coffers and the studios and here. That's why here a lot, almost of the, you know, that studio we choose for photo.
Yes, yes.
For the wedding.
Yes, yes.
We have many here. We have also a lot of coiffeurs for the.
A coiffeur, you know, is a hairdresser,
yeah,
by the way,
exactly.
Guys.
That's why, and the, you know, that's the people they came with them and making that's just for, you know.
Well, actually, as you're speaking, here
you see,
comes a wedding party right
now. There's a wedding party. Cars, scooters, motorcycles.
Yeah.
Now, unfortunately, guys, you can't see it, but you can hear.
Yeah.
The noise.
Yeah.
As all the motorbikes, you've got the car in front. We've got a car, literally. We're on a corniche in front of us, really.
Yeah.
And we've got the wedding car now just going past. This is all decked out.
They're waving at us.
And we're waving at the bride and groom right now. And the bride and groom are waving back at us. That was wonderful.
And you see, almost of the coffees of the. The studio, the coiffeurs, it's here on the River Nile.
It's absolutely wonderful.
It's a beautiful car, you see.
There's cars all decked out, and then there's buses and buses and buses. There's motorcycles, and as you can hear, they're all beeping their horns in celebration. And the buses are full with family members on both the groom side and on the bride side.
And if it seems like we've been distracted, we have.
Just a tad. So, back to the Serapeum. Ahmed, what was the importance of the Apis Bull within the Apis Bull itself? Why was it so important within the Memphite religion? Because it was Memphis, really. There was no Apis Bull in Thebes.
Apis Bull in ancient time was the symbol of fertility. You know, the Egyptian, that's all the symbol of fertility.
The symbol of fertility.
A symbol of fertility.
Okay.
First things, symbol of power.
Power.
One of the main names, especially for the great kings, looks like Ramses II and the Marie Imbetah from the New Kingdom. Even, you know, that's kings also from the late period of Egypt, even during the Greco-Roman time. One of the main titles of the kings,
yes,
he took this name as Apol, the strong Paul, one of his main names.
Right, so it was
one of John's nicknames, the strong bull.
Yeah,
that is my nickname actually.
Oh, he is.
I'm
strong like ox.
You know,
strong like ox, smart like cart.
And just tell me, where did you find those things?
What things?
The tombs of this animal. Where?
In Saqqara.
In Saqqara, that's
Saqqara.
Right. What the main things in Saqqara?
Pyramids and tombs, mastabas.
You mean that's a group of whom? Zoser.
No, Dozer, yes.
Group of Zoser.
Dozer.
That's
one of
the oldest, I mean, ritual of the Egyptian, that we call it Hepset.
The Hepset Festival.
Hepset Festival.
We know
Hepset?
Yes, yes.
The unit that before the history, we know that there is every 30 years, they're using to bring a very weak one of this animal, and they ask the king to follow this animal, and when he catch this animal, he took the skin of this pole. That means he had the strong and the fertility of this animal. This became lead. That's why that animal was very, very important for the Egyptians.
Now, I remember a story, and Scotty, this is something we're going to be writing about next year, or this year, for the Lost Armies of Pharaoh, and that is that, am I right here, Ahmed, that, excuse me,
yes.
That Cambyses actually killed one of the Apis bulls by puncturing its side with one of his daggers.
Yeah.
The very dagger itself that actually killed him in the very end as well.
Yeah.
He actually killed him.
Yeah.
But he punctured the thigh of the Apis bull, and it later died from its wounds. And the high priest of Memphis secretly performed the ceremony and the burial.
Yeah.
Now, how do you... And just... just humour me here. Yeah. How would you perform a secret burial with a sarcophagus the size of a bus? How could you do that secretly? You couldn't.
It's not secret.
No, but he did. They
That's
so,
why.
So they say the priest performed the ceremony and the burial of the dead Apis Ball that Cambus had murdered. They performed it secretly. He found out, and he was so enraged that he destroyed the mummified corpse of the Apis Ball afterwards and killed the priests.
As the story goes.
As the story goes. But I it came to me today while there, looking at the size of these sarcophagi, that it would be almost impossible to actually perform the ritual privately or secretly, because they're so huge. To actually actually pull one of those sarcophagi.
That's as that story, but it was not secretly But the problem was that they need a special one.
They need a special one to replace the dead one.
Science.
Yes, the special
it's
science.
It's like, you know, that had someone something in his tail.
Now, wasn't it the sign of Osiris?
I mean, not exactly, but they need something. It's so some people I don't know if it's okay to talk about. Some people connected between that things, its ritual, and the story of watching Holy Quran and watching in the Bible. That's when the people of Moses, they ask him about the what the size of the cow he needs.
Right.
You know the story?
Continue.
Yeah, no, this is beautiful in our Holy Quran. That's when Moses, he asked it that because of they made something wrong, the people of Moses, and he asked them, just Allah ask you to cut a cow, just any cow, because of they was, I mean, with them they ask what the kind of this cow. He said that he need, Allah asking, he said that he need with a very simple signs, you know, and that's what the signs of it. He looking for more and more and more till became too difficult to find this. Finally, they found it in a very poor man. This man, you know, this man, he told them, "We need, I need to the weight of this cow with gold." So it's getting difficult because they're asking for more and more. If they just choose any cow, it would be okay. But they went because of he was talking with Allah more and more and more. So imagine that this became the most expensive cow, which is Allah and Moses, they use it and they use its spoons, you know, to they discover that who's make the crime and something. It became a sacred cow. Some people, they connect between this, especially, you know, that this story happened here in Egypt during the time of Moses, you know.
Well, this is what's interesting.
I don't know, John, he didn't write something about this in his book. You know, this is new things. Maybe in the second publication you can do.
This is what we have found very interesting. We insist that Moses and the Israelites, when he led them out of Egypt, they were Egyptians by that time. They may have had Israelite bloodlines, but they were pure Egyptian. They lived there for hundreds of years. Egyptians in the sense, it's like saying this.
I mean, they were living in Egypt, but not
Egyptians. But they were Egyptian.
They were living in Egypt for...
We've had this discussion before.
Many times.
Yes, I discussed before.
We had this discussion for hours still, at Silsila.
Yeah, I'm still saying that they're... It's okay, they are there. That's why when Moses asked Pharaoh, you know, I need my people. He didn't say, and when he come out from Egypt, he didn't take all of the Egyptians with him. He took just his people. He didn't take all of the Egyptians.
Well, our contention is this, historically. It's like saying, I have Scottish blood and Welsh blood in me, but my family has lived in America for 300 years.
You became American.
So I'm American.
Yeah, I know.
So, but I have Scott and Welsh blood. Now, this is
I'm
what
not
I
talking,
contend.
Excuse me. I'm not talking about the nationality.
Okay.
But we're talking, they know that they came from the time of Joseph. It's about 400 before Moses.
Yes.
But they were living in a very separated things. Even they have their own places, their own houses, their own customs. And if there's struggle between the Egyptian and the Jewish, especially if you know that the Egyptian, they were eating the pigs, but the Jews not eating, that something, mm-hmm. something like that, you know. They have their customs. But that's why Moses is asking for what? For his people. He didn't ask for all of them. Maybe they were Egyptian because of they living in Egypt, but they're not maybe half Egyptian or something like that.
What we are contending is that there, if you look at even the Old Testament in the Bible, the Hebrew Bible, you will find that there are so many similarities to Egyptian culture, Egyptian practice, Egyptian spirituality that were carried over and adapted by them, that they were, in a sense, Egyptianized by the time that they were led out of Egypt by that story. And that's where I think with the Apis bull, all these parts you're talking about for the different sacrifices.
Maybe
this
that's
is all carried over.
Something else as well about, just to complete our story, when Moses, he took his people outside of Egypt in Sinai, you know?
Yes.
What did they do after Moses, he left them to meet his God for 40 days. The Jews?
Yes.
What? They worshipped what?
A gold cow.
What's at the top of Surabat
al-Kadim? In our Holy Quran, they say that they still have, in our Holy Quran, they still have the cow in their minds.
Yes.
Because they worshipped the cow.
But what is at the top of Surabat al-Kadim?
The temple to Hathor.
And what is Hathor?
It's a cow.
So is there not a connection there?
Yeah, maybe there's a connection between that.
This is where we contend Moses was. Not St. Catherine's.
No, Surabat al-Khadim.
He went up there for 40 days and
built a golden tablet,
a representation of Hathor.
Yeah, that's good.
No, it's fantastic. So the Apis bull then. So, we're happy to. Thank you, Scotty.
That was a non-verbal hand signal I was
that
giving
wasn't
him
even
that
a
we
hand
have,
signal.
That
was
we have
a,
two and a half minutes left.
That was a prod in the arm. just to wrap up, how many sarcophagi have we got in the Serapeum altogether? It's about 27, isn't it?
27.
There's 27 altogether.
In Serapeum.
Yes. In the Serapeum.
There was about 30 or something like that.
27,
you know that
27
is many.
To 30.
Yeah, something like that.
27 to 30.
Yeah, yeah.
Anywhere between that number.
Yeah.
Give or
now,
take one or two.
Yeah, yeah.
We did see one today as well, though. That was a black granite. Now,
Grey granite.
I couldn't answer the question in my own mind. Nobody asked me, thankfully. Yeah. No one actually asked me the question. Yeah. Thankfully, they didn't. Yeah. But where are the grey granite quarries? In Aswan.
The grey?
Granite. Where?
To the south of Aswan.
Whereabouts? Just so I got that from my mind. I mean, it's not so...
I know,
the information is...
That's beside the right. Came from Red Sea.
Well, that's what I was thinking, because
Red
you know
sea,
why I asked this
Red
question?
Red Sea, yeah.
You know why I asked
because
this
you
question?
Know that you have quite a granite
the mountain,
came from Red Sea.
The mountain that we climbed on the day that we arrived at Serabit el-Khadim.
Yes.
Not the Serabit el-Khadim mountain itself.
Just for your guys, we've got less than one and a half minutes left now.
But we quickly, just to recap here, we climbed a small mountain on the day that we arrived, just to have a reconnaissance around the area. Now, but the mountain itself was made of grey granite.
Yes, it was.
And so one could easily say, and this then ties into Hapu, because I actually say within the story of Hapu...
You always have to bring up that Hapu character.
He's pivotal. Yeah. But Wadi Hammamat?
Why not?
And folks, we're down to the last 30 seconds
right,
of the show.
That's it.
This discussion will probably carry on beyond this recording.
You.
But we want to thank you for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
And,
thank you very much, Chuck.
Folks,
you.
We are going to be back tomorrow night with another
Inshallah.
30 minutes. Well, tomorrow night is actually our live radio show for two hours.
Yeah.
And so we'll be back for 2 hours tomorrow night, live from right here aboard the Dahabeah, going up the Nile River to the south. And listen for our daily updates for the next week and a half.
Yep.
And this is Scotty Roberts, Dr. John Ward. We're signing off for tonight.
Take care. Good night.
Good night. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.